You found the Diggin' Oak Island podcast, podcaster's journey to discover the truth behind the Oak Island mystery. I'm Dave McBride. Thank you so much for downloading and listening. If you listen to or subscribe to the show on iTunes or really anywhere else you get your podcast, please, please, please leave us a 5-star rating there. Also, I invite you to join us on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow the show at Diggin' Oak Island. Well, my vacation is over. Usually I'd be seriously depressed about that, but on this particular vacation, my 5-year-old son and I spent most of it sick with a cold or a flu or something like that, and the two of us hardly ever got out of bed for the last few days, so it's actually nice to be home again, feeling a little bit better, and talking about Oak Island with you. But if you detect a little bit of a little difference in my voice, or maybe you detect a couple of extra edits, something like that, or you hear me coughing, you'll know that's where it all is coming from. We have two shows to cover today, both episodes 11 and 12 of The Curse of Oak Island, but let's begin today by answering some more of your emails and messages. I love this part. First up is Jim. Jim writes, I am enjoying your podcast. How can I get videos of early season Curse of Oak Island TV shows? Well, Jim, there are many ways, actually, and one of the great things the History Channel has done with the show is they've made the archives of old episodes really pretty readily available for fans who have joined the party late, so to speak. Just off the top of my head, I know you can stream it on History Channel's website, also on Amazon Prime. I'm not sure, but I think only the first season is available on Netflix at this time. I particularly, personally, watch them on demand for free through DirecTV. And this year, they also released, I believe just this past year, a comprehensive DVD set that includes the entire first 6 seasons worth of shows. They're out there, Jim. Go find them. Have yourself a binge watch. Enjoy. If you have any questions, you know where to direct them. Right through that same email address you directed that one. Jason writes, so glad I found your podcast. I'm glad you found it too, Jason. Whatever happened to that scientist that hypothesized that the boulders in Nolan's Cross were placed based on constellations? They put that theory to the test and found other boulders where he said they would be based on the constellation. Then we heard nothing else about this guy. Any ideas? Well, I believe, Jason, you're referring to a doctor named Travis Taylor. He's an astrophysicist and presented a theory involving points on a star map that seemed to line up with places on Oak Island and on neighboring Apple Island, which is just another small island not far in Mahone Bay. After presenting his theory in the war room, Taylor and the team, a couple members of the team at least, traveled around Oak Island finding large boulders that did seem to match up with his star map. The team does some additional searching using Taylor's theory later on. They go out on Apple Island, I believe, and do some metal detecting, and they find a couple possible targets. But if I'm not mistaken, permitting issues keep them from digging, especially on Apple Island. So the entire project was simply left hanging there. We've heard nothing at all since then. No word that maybe they're going to try to get these permits for Apple Island and do some searching around and see what might be there. But Jason, this is by no means a unique or a new phenomenon for the Curse of Oak Island and these type of theories. And Taylor is certainly not the only guy to ever present a well-researched and what seems to be compelling theory, only to have it lost to time and never heard of again on the show. We can hope the team is following up off camera, but who knows for sure. I do have contact with a few of the theorists who have been on the show, but not Mr. Taylor, at least not yet. So I don't have any good answers for you on this one. I'm sorry. Let's move on to a listener named Dwayne. He writes, just started listening. I love it. As for the tar paper, who's to say the gold seekers out west that supposedly used tar paper first on roofs was not one of the people who built the Oak Island box or a descendant of one who heard stories from Grandpa? Just what popped into my head. What Dwayne is referring to is the first kind of new structure found this year within this bump out section of the cofferdam in Smith's Cove. It kind of looks like a big wooden box and reminds me a lot of some of the other Smith's Cove's workings done by the Restalls, specifically the shafts they dug, which they did while trying to locate and shut off the flood tunnels in the cove. When the box structure was first unearthed, the seaward side of it was covered in what was obviously a tar paper. That tar paper was rather quickly ignored by the narrator in favor of more fun Knights Templar nonsense and that kind of thing. Tar paper, at least in this country, was most likely, at least this is the best information I've come up with, invented in sort of the mid-19th century by gold rushers out west in California and places like that. And they used it as use on for a roof for these sort of quickly constructed makeshift cabin-type things that they built to live in while they were working out in the field. So if nothing else, it certainly serves as proof that the structure is indeed a searcher-built structure and not something, you know, from the Knights Templar or Francis Bacon or whoever you theorize originally dug the money pit. This structure, this box, was definitively built after the discovery of the money pit. We know that. Not long after the discovering of the box, the team essentially stopped focusing on it, turning its attention to the area more directly in front of the supposed slipway found last season. And for good reason, probably. I mean, you see, no matter who built this wooden box and where or who learned about the tar paper, the fact is that the structure is absolutely searcher built, and until there is some evidence suggesting to me otherwise, the very existence of this tar paper is the single best and really indisputable evidence of this post discovery of the money pit origin. That's what's most important to me. But more to your point, you could very well be correct, and I don't know of any gold rushers in particular who worked on Oak Island or anyone specifically related to a 49er. But there have been many, many, many mining, you know, and construction experts and people like that who have worked on Oak Island. If anyone would have had that information quickly, you would suppose it would be someone in one of those fields. And finally, we got a great email from Steve who writes, "Just discovered the podcast and I'm now working backwards through the episodes. I've been loosely following the Oak Island story since probably the 1990s and I watched the TV show with fascination. Two questions. I apologize if either has been answered on an older episode and haven't hit it yet. On the show, they occasionally display a plot map of the island. It's clear that the Laginas own most of the island and that the Nolans own part of the island. But there are small numbers, 2 through 4, of lots that don't appear to be owned by either the Laginas or the Nolans. Who do these belong to? I can't recall that ever being addressed on the show. Following the timeline that has played out on the show, there's a very large historical window involved. From the creation of the swamp as early as the 1220s to the discovery of the money pit by Daniel McGinnis in 1795. That's around 575 years. Could it be that the true Oak Island mystery is simply," and he writes in quotes, "word of mouth. That is that over time, the reputation of the island as a great place to hide people and things attracted many groups, Templar, Spanish, French, British, American, Canadian, etc., to do many things on the island over time for many reasons. As an aside, when I heard that 1220s swamp creation date, I found myself wondering if maybe it wasn't the Templars responsible for the work, but rather one of the First Nation tribes of Nova Scotia. I know there's been speculation on the show about contact between the Templars and the native people." Okay, let's start with question number one, and there's so many layers to this, so we got some great conversation here. I thank you for this question. Let's start with number one, about the ownership of the island. As far as I know, and there's some sourcing on this, but it is private information, but it is out there. You have the vast majority of the island now owned by the Laginas, the Blankenships, or some entity involving the Laginas and the Blankenships. Also, the Nolan family still owns lots 9 through 14. Now, from the information I got, that leaves us with, I think, only one lot not owned by one of those two parties, by either the old, by either Dan himself or the group together of the, which is called Oak Island Tours, or, stuff that came from former partners of Dan Blankenship and the Nolans. There's really only one lot. Now, Fred Nolan, famously, we've talked about this a lot, famously backdoored his way onto the island by purchasing lots 5 and 9 through 14 out from under Mel Chapel. You can listen to my last podcast for more on that fascinating little story. In 1996, Fred sold off Lot 5, which is on the northwestern side of the island, to an industrial designer and wood technology specialist from Ontario named Robert Young. It was the only lot that he had that was not connected to the others and also didn't include areas like the swamp or where Nolan's Cross was found. These were the areas where he did the bulk of his work. So it was just sort of like a separate little plot. Now, Young doesn't have a house or anything like that on Lot 5. But between 1998 and 2008, he did get himself a treasure trove license from the Canadian government so he could dig and explore there on his new little piece of property. And really, Young found all sorts of cool little artifacts, including old coins, buttons, military stuff, you know, the kinds of things that look a lot like the stuff Gary Drayton finds on a regular basis, really all over the island. If you're interested in learning more about Young and his finds, he does have a website, oakislandlot5.com, where he has posted dozens of great photos of these things and even tells his own sort of Oak Island story. Now, in your question there, you asked specifically about lots 2 through 4, so I don't want to go on to your next point without discussing those few. They are on the northwestern side of the island, probably the furthest point away from the money pit, and certainly the furthest point from Smith's Cove. They are, to the best of my knowledge, owned by the Oak Island Tours Company, which is the partnership between the Laginas and everybody else that's there. Originally owned by the Triton Alliance, which was the partnership, the company that owned that Blankenship and his partner Dave Tobias owned. So those are not mysterious lots. They definitely have ownership that I can find, at least here. So there you go. That's the best I have. It's just that one lot. If anybody else has more information on that that's different, let me know. Email me, digginoakisland@gmail.com. Now let's move on to that second question in Steve's email. Let me repeat just a part of it. You can remember what we're talking about here. He asked, quote, following the timeline that has played out on the show, there's a very large historical window involved, from the creation of the swamp as early as the 1220s to the discovery of the money pit by Daniel McGinnis in 1795. That's around 575 years. Could it be that the true Oak Island mystery is simply the word of mouth? That over time, the reputation of the island is a great place to hide people and things attracted by many groups, Templar, Spanish, French, British, American, Canadian, etc., do many things on the island over time for many reasons. It's a great question. And let's face it, this is truly just a very logical observation that anyone would notice just from watching the show over the last 7 seasons. I mean, if all you knew about Oak Island came from the Curse of Oak Island television show, then here is just a little sampler of the things discovered and the years they were dated to. We had a lead cross from before the 15th century. We had wood timbers from like right around 1770. We had a brooch that dated to the mid-14th century or even earlier. We had a Spanish coin marked 1652. We had human bones dated from the first half of the 18th century. And then we had a Roman-era pilum, which is a spear tip, really. And that's just scratching the surface and also doesn't include anything discovered before the Laginas in their time here searching. It is, for lack of a better term, all over the darn place when it comes to trying to place a time frame. Just when you think you at least have a time period nailed down, some new piece of evidence seems to show up and from a completely different century. What every searcher looks for, really, is something that they can date to from before the discovery of the money pit, something from before 1795. That gives you an idea that this was at least not built by searchers. But as you can see, just from these 6 things I listed that were discovered only in the last decade or so, the time frames of those things span a millennium or even more. The point is, Steve, you're by no means the only person to think along these lines and wonder if there is more to the story than just one single depositor. Let's be honest. If nothing else, we can say for sure the Knights Templar did not bring a Spanish coin marked 1652 to Oak Island. And we could probably say pretty sure that George Washington wasn't carrying around a Roman pilum. So what does it all mean when we put it together? Well, that's what makes Oak Island so great. This jumbled timeline of different centuries and different histories and different possibilities is just wonderful. And it's going to have some more strange stops on it in the episodes we're about to discuss. And yes, without getting too much into it right now, because it is a fascinating subject that deserves much more time than we have today and has been really addressed by historians all over North America, especially in the last few years. The Mi'kmaq tribe, the First Nations tribe that has lived on the Nova Scotia for thousands of years, has indeed been linked to the Knights Templar by many historians, and even by some, you know, what we would describe as tribal historians as well. You needn't look any further than something called the Grand Council flag of the Mi'kmaq Nation. Google it and have a look for yourself, and you'll see an amazing Templar connection right there on that flag. But like I said, that's not the only one. Thanks again to everyone for your questions and your emails. Please, please, please keep them coming. I love answering these, and I love hearing what you guys are really interested here when it comes to Oak Island. If you'd like to email me your thoughts or questions as well for us to discuss here on a future show, you can do so at digginoakisland@gmail.com. So let's now discuss The Curse of Oak Island, Season 7, Episode 11, entitled The Eye of the Storm, and Episode 12, which was called Fortified. Now, for the purposes of this review, I'm going to pretty much lump the two of these episodes together. It's just easier that way. There wasn't really much new from Episode 11, if I'm honest, as it was really kind of dominated by the approach and the landfall of Hurricane Dorian. For anyone who doesn't recall, or perhaps you don't live in the East Coast and North America and the story just wasn't all that big in your local news, Hurricane Dorian was that storm from late August of 2016, late summer, that made landfall in the Bahamas, most famously as a Category 5 storm, making it really one of the strongest hurricanes on record to ever hit that part of the Bahamas. I mean, it caused there billions of dollars in property damage, left thousands of people homeless, and over 300 people, I think, either killed or missing. Some islands were really, in that area of the Bahamas, really just laid to waste by Dorian, for lack of a better term. By the time the storm made its way all the way up to Nova Scotia on September 7th, it had downgraded to something around a Category 1 size storm, with winds closing in at around 100 miles an hour, just a little bit less than that, I think. Certainly not life-threatening, but still a very significant and dangerous storm, especially for a small island like Oak Island. And just take a look at what these guys have out there on this island. large sheets of plywood to walk around on, heavy freestanding equipment, large metal tools. These type of things, even in a Category 1 storm, can become dangerous. Projectiles in a storm. So not only does the work need to stop during the storm itself, it needs to stop for days before in order to secure all this stuff down. Anyone who lives in Florida can tell you all about that. So you can see why this storm was on the minds of the Laginas and their team. And Dorian is mentioned over and over and over again by the narrator during Episode 11. Like I said, it pretty much dominated the episode. But truth be told, you know, they really did okay on Oak Island. Besides having to repump the swamp and make some repairs to the causeway, and I think they had to clear a couple of down trees, things appeared to get back to normal pretty quickly without any real lasting effects on the work. I'm really not sure why they kept saying this storm could cause work to stop for the rest of the season, even though it was only like the first week in September. And these guys are often working, you know, deep into October, even in November. But we can, I guess, just chalk that up to sort of dramatic effect by the narrator and stuff. I'm not really sure about that, but they did say that quite a few times. It was a little puzzling. Now, before we get into the bulk of the work done in these two episodes, which was done in Smith's Cove in the swamp, let me just mention a couple of quick things besides those two places. In Episode 11, the team is looking at core drilling samples in the area of the Money Pit. They're looking for the precise location of the original Oak Island treasure shaft. What they are doing here is trying to find what the narrator calls a way to, quote, pinpoint the best location for a large-scale excavation. Now, from what I can gather from this here, they are using these smaller, easier, cheaper drilling samples to kind of get a confident idea of where the money pit might just be before sinking one of those huge cans that you've seen in past episodes and locations all around the money pit. And with that can, they can really start pulling stuff out of there. I got to tell you, if that's in our future, I'm certainly excited by that possibility. They bring up samples of what geologist Terry Matheson calls hand-cut wood from a depth of around 106 feet. It seems from this scene, the team is pretty confident they have indeed found evidence of the actual wood used to build the original money pit. And therefore, this could be the place they are looking for to drop one of these big cans. However, nothing more is mentioned of it in this episode, and we really get nothing in the Money Pit area at all for episode 12. So let's just assume they're sort of holding on to that for future episodes. In episode 12, Gary Drayton, Jack Begley, and Peter Frenetti are metal detecting out on Lot 27. It's a place they've been before. Lot 27 is on the southern shore of the island, kind of right about in the middle of the island there. It's the place where Gary Drayton found an old chisel, from a few episodes back, if you remember that one. This time he finds a musket ball in the woods, and then when he was out on the beach, he finds the head of an old axe that's sort of clumped into this mess of rocks and rust and all that kind of stuff. There's certainly a lot of speculating from the guys about the axe's age and its origin and maybe its even purpose, but there's really nothing concrete. There's no testing or anything like that. So I think we can just sort of assume we'll be getting back to this artifact in a future episode. If not, you can safely assume there was nothing really to it. So let's head down to the beach, shall we? Like I said, most of the major work done during these two episodes was done at the swamp and at Smith's Cove. So let's start at Smith's Cove. If you recall, the focus of the team's attention has been on this new structure unearthed in episode 9 in the new bump-out area, directly in front of the supposed slipway. Not the wooden box we discussed earlier in the email section, but this other couple of, that's just three or four timbers, I think, just to the east of that and really on a line directly from the slipway. During episode 11, Gary Drayton and Jack Begley are metal detecting in this area of the bump out, and they're not only the area, the grounds, but also in these giant piles of dirt brought out by the excavator while exposing the structure. Drayton locates more of what he calls crib spikes. Basically, these are big old nails that could have been used for a variety of applications. They take these spikes to blacksmithing expert Carmen Legg, one of my faves on the show. Great accent, though I have no idea why they always subtitle the guy, but they do. He tells the guys that the spikes look like they're from before 1820. This is probably due to the way they're made, and maybe back as far as the 1600s. And it's always that earlier date that the narrator seems to annoyingly obsess over. He also says, when asked about their possible use, that his, quote, best guess is for reinforcing a wall that was built along the edge of the water, end quote. Doesn't seem all that earth-shattering, considering where they found it. It's good information, but honestly, nothing new or groundbreaking here. I mean, I can't imagine Drayton is at all shocked to find spikes with possible maritime applications on a beach in Nova Scotia. There is, however, an interesting moment after he finds the spikes when Drayton expresses his dismay over the lack of personal types of artifacts being found in the area. So far, it seems they have found some waterfront structures and probably some nails or something used to build them or build some other waterfront-related something or other. But weirdly, they haven't found anything that seems to indicate the actual presence of people. Nothing personal, nothing that can tell us who might have built all this and why. And by this, I mean things like jewelry or coins or pottery or, you know, those kinds of things. It's just buildings and building materials. Where did everything else go? Now, I've told this story before, and I'll tell it to you again, but I used to own a boat. It was for a few years, and I kept it on a marina, docked at a marina for the summers. If you looked under that dock now, you'd find some keys of mine, more than one pair of sunglasses, lots of quarters, and certainly a cell phone or two. And the list can go on and on and on. And I wasn't there working every day. I was only relaxing on it for a few days in the summer. Gary's right. You would think there would be some evidence of people, something left behind by the folks who did all this work. But weirdly, so far nothing. It's almost as if somebody came in and cleared it all out. So now this structure we're talking about involves at least one really large and fully intact timber. The team cuts a piece of it, sends it to be dated using a method called dendrochronology. We talked about it a lot before. It's just a fancy name for tree ring dating. It's a simple method, but it's also very, very accurate. At the start of episode 12, Craig Tester is on a video call to the rest of the crew who are in the war room to report on the results of the test. The timber's origin is of a red spruce. There's nothing surprising there. Red spruce trees are found from the Appalachian Mountains to the Adirondacks, through New England, all the way up through Quebec and Nova Scotia. But the date, he reports, is fascinating, with a result of 1741. I have to say, this is nothing short of a truly intriguing and significant find for a couple of reasons, reasons the team discusses here in this scene. Number one, this is a truly concrete find. I don't know how other way to put that. What I mean is this wasn't something that was sort of accidentally dropped there in passing. While a medieval religious artifact or a Spanish coin can certainly be cool and could possibly add to a story, these are very small objects that can easily be transported all over the world and for centuries after they've been made. But not this timber. This timber was cut down locally. And the structure it was part of was built here on Oak Island and purposely placed where it was for some reason yet to be determined. Its life story, at least in that regard, is not in question. It's not here by accident. Number two, 1741 really puts the structure's origin into a time period before any real residential habitation of European settlers in this area. In fact, as I think even Marty points out in the war room scene, the bigger towns in the area weren't even founded until a few years later, with Chester, which is one of the local towns you see a lot, being founded in 1759, and then the town of Mahone Bay being founded in 1754. So while I've debated many, many times as to whether Oak Island was indeed uninhabited when the money pit was discovered in 1795, it is pretty safe to say it was not inhabited in 1741 when this structure was built, or at least when this tree that we're looking at was felled for the purpose of being built, used to build this structure. So what does that all mean? It means, for one, this wasn't built by an early resident trying to find a good place to park his boat while on a summer vacation. Therefore, it also seems to limit the possibilities here significantly, at least the good possibilities. As far as I can tell, either this was built by the Mi'kmaq tribe, possibly pirates, I guess, or some other sort of passing merchant mariners or something along those lines. Or maybe as part of some sort of undocumented military expedition. We know all three of these things existed in Mahone Bay at the time. They seem to be at least the most likely explanations I can come up with, certainly not the only ones. So with that in mind, the conversation then turns towards the military angle and eventually to what this French-built fortress of Louisbourg. Now, the saga of the fortress at Louisbourg has been, well, they call it Louisbourg, but has been popular among Oak Island researchers and theorists for ages and ages. And we've talked about this on the podcast before. But in case you're new to the show or you just don't remember, let me bring you up to speed and give you sort of the nickel version of the story. Okay, maybe it's the dime version. It's 1713. A collection of treaties called the Peace of Utrecht are signed, bringing the War of Spanish Succession, a European-wide and therefore a global, really, conflict to an end. As part of these treaties, France and England essentially divide up Canada, with England on the winning side of the war and taking possession of much of this area. The French, who were on the losing end of the war, are forced to give up most of their territories in what is now the Canadian Maritimes, including Nova Scotia. However, they do retain control of Cape Breton Island, which is on the northeastern tip of Nova Scotia. At the time, they called it Isle Royale. For all intents and purposes, Cape Breton became the only real foothold, the only real stronghold France had in this incredibly important strategic and economic part of the New World. So considering how often France and England seemed to like to end up on opposite sides of wars with each other at this time, France felt it was a good idea, probably rightly so, to build a really large and impressive fortification on Cape Breton called the Fortress at Louisbourg, or Louisbourg, I guess. They poured a huge amount of money into it, and it took them about 25 years to complete. But when they were done, they had one of the biggest, if not the biggest, military installation in all of North America. Not long after it was completed, predictably, another European war breaks out in 1740, I think, and the fighting extends again across the Atlantic to Canada and North America. This one is called over here the King George's War. I think it was called something like the War of Austrian Succession or something like that. It was during this war in 1745, to be exact, the British, or really I should say the Americans, because they were under the command of a rich merchant named Colonel William Pepperell, who was from Kittery, Maine. These guys sacked the fortress, and then it fell into the hands of what were colonial British forces. About a year later, France sort of resolved to take it back and sent a man with the exhausting name of Jean-Baptiste Louis Frédéric de La Rochefoucauld de Roye, better known as the Duc d'Anville, with a force of, I think, 50 more or more ships and about 13,000 men to head over across the Atlantic and try to win the fortress back for the French. The attempt failed miserably as terrible weather and disease and all that kind of stuff dashed really any hopes of what could have been a successful military mission. In fact, the Duke himself died from typhoid in the process. And apparently, he was later buried in Louisbourg. That's something I never knew before this show. Now, the theory is some of these ships, after being ravaged by storms and from disease as well, stopped off at Oak Island and buried their most valuable treasure to keep it out of British hands. Remember, besides soldiers, food, and firearm, these expeditions have to carry a lot of cash with them to fund, you know, what they're doing along the way. With the constant threat of British attack and the forces already severely weakened, it does make some sense that they would not want to be caught holding all their cash and might bury this stuff in something kind of secret. It seems like a rather desperate measure by, which I guess were probably desperate men for sure, seeing that Oak Island was firmly in British territory at the time. But anyway, that's the theory we're working with here. This dendrochronology testing, while certainly not suggesting the Duc d'Anville cut the tree down himself, it at least puts this timber into the time frame of this theory. As a result, Rick Lagina and Doug Kroll travel the few hundred miles, I think, out to Cape Breton Island to visit the fortress at Louisbourg. Now, I'll have to admit, there really isn't much here in these scenes at Louisbourg that adds to our Oak Island story. But at the same time, this is a site which has figured into Oak Island lore for ages, and I really relish the chance to see it presented here on the show. It's an incredibly impressive fort on a gorgeous little bit of land. But really, the connections are exaggerated a lot here. The cross, the drains, they're really kind of overplayed. The relationship between the things that we all see here at Louisbourg and in this fort and what's been found in Oak Island is coincidental at best in my mind. And yet the narrator really kind of makes a meal of it. All in all, the Louisbourg theory has some great compelling evidence to it. And it has some problems with it for sure. But here is my conclusion from what we get in this episode, episode 12. Let's not come to any conclusion just yet. This date of 1741 does fit into the Louisbourg theory very well. But the dating on the other structures in Smith's Cove, the U-shape, the L-shaped structure, they don't fit into this theory very well. So we need to kind of figure this all out before we can consider this evidence as backing any one particular theory. Finally, let's finish off in Marty Lagina's beloved swamp. Like I mentioned before, much of episode 11 is spent talking about the approaching Hurricane Dorian and how the team was essentially rushing to get as much done as they possibly could before the storm hit Nova Scotia. While digging, Rick pulls out a couple of wooden stakes, I believe six-sided stakes, which they compare to similar stakes that Fred Nolan found decades before searching in this area. Nolan claimed to have these stakes carbon dated to as far back as the 16th century, so these are certainly interesting and worth examining. Hopefully the Laginas can find some interesting dating information on the stakes they found as well. What I would really like to see is the location where these stakes were recovered plotted onto a map. It's important to keep in mind that the swamp has changed quite a bit over the centuries. Sea levels have risen, the road between it and the ocean was added at the beginning of the 20th century, so that obviously changed things. So it's possible these are just property markers put into the ground during the later 1700s when the area was maybe still possibly above water. The lack of information presented in the show here doesn't make that possible to determine, really. I'm also fascinated by the fact that this particular scene, we have Rick, Marty, and Craig doing all the work. The bosses, so to speak. My wife pointed it out to me when we were watching it and said something like, I wonder if they really thought they were going to find something big here. Well, they didn't really, at least not yet. What they're trying to find during all of this is something they refer to as the paved area. If you remember in an episode earlier this season, local diver Tony Sampson explored this area using a long metal rod to poke down into the dirt below the water to get an idea of what was down there. He discovered what he said felt like a raised area. He called it a road. It's kind of this raised area, flat rocks that felt like an old rock road. If the team could actually uncover such a thing, that would really thicken the plot here significantly. As work progresses, they really start to struggle with getting the area cleaned of mud and water in order to get a good look at these rocks in this area. Craig finds a few stones, but he seems skeptical at first, for sure. What Craig is seeing just doesn't look like a road to him, I don't think. They don't seem to be flagstones or something that really look like paving stones. Steve Guptill and Billy Gerhart, the guy operating the excavator, are a little bit more optimistic, I think, pointing out how the area is definitely raised and has a defined kind of edge to it. But lo and behold, Hurricane Dorian finally hits, and the swamp is filled back up with seawater, by the way. So it's pushing over the road here, and they need to sort of start from scratch and repump it all out. But they do that within about a week. And you know, it's only a few days, I think he said, about maybe a week's time before it's completely redrained. And now it seems that they're actually able to move the mud and the water out of the way finally and get a good look at these rocks. With this incredibly cool swamp excavator we talked about in the last show, Billy digs right up along the edge of it, essentially exposing one side of this raised area to get a better look at its makeup and the depth of it. The initial scientist on the scene is geologist Terry Matheson, and he's the first to find this anomaly, I guess is the word to use. He's first to find it strange. He points out how surprising it is to find those boulders, these size boulders that they're showing you here, so close to the surface, relaying how it's his experience in the Money Pit area, at least, that these rocks, rocks that match this size are found at a much, much deeper depth. Next on the scene is Dr. Ian Spooner. We all remember him. He's the swamp doctor. We've seen him a number of times now. He agrees that the shallowness of the rocks that we're looking at here is indeed strange. And when asked if he thought it was man-made, the answer he gives is, quote, "It's different enough for me to consider that." That is a great, really signature scientist response, I gotta say. Archaeologist Laird Niven arrives next, and he is much more definitive, saying it looks unnatural to him, using the word introduced to describe how the stones may have gotten there. I think he used that word, if I'm correct with that. Now, that's three experts in three very different scientific fields, all rendering the same general opinion here. And folks, that's got me excited about this. The swamp doctor says, quote, "In my mind, somebody created a surface," end quote, and also notes that he, quote, "can't find a natural process that would have led to this," end quote. I mean, anyway, slice it. The team is onto something unusual here for sure. In grand Curse of Oak Island tradition, Rick, while standing with the swamp doctor, sends his brothers some photos and then makes one of those, you know, really ubiquitous speakerphone calls to Marty to tell him all about what they found. Marty asks the perfect next question, and the one that I had in my mind. If this is man-made, to what end? What is it? What could this have been used for? Why would this be here? And surprisingly, at least surprising to me, the swamp doctor renders an opinion. Usually this comes from, you know, Gary Drayton or somebody like that who just throws out some idea they have in their head. He points out that if you start at the eye and then follow sort of a straight line towards this paved area and then out to the sea, between the paved area and the ocean itself is the deepest part of the swamp. Now, it's hard for me to visualize here in audio, but what he seems to be suggesting is that the deep part might have been an inlet at some point, and then this sort of paved area, this rock area, was placed here as some sort of, you know, reinforced workspace, kind of like a makeshift dock where boats could pull up and then offload their heavy cargo. Frankly, you don't expect that kind of speculation from a scientist, but maybe that speaks to the confidence in his opinion here. Or, you know, gotta say it, maybe it appears the swamp doctor is getting a little bit of that famous Oak Island fever as well. Any way you slice it, this discovery is huge in my mind. We have three experts who all agree this does not belong here. It does not. It's not a natural thing, and now we have it in this swamp underwater, and it's crazy to think about it that way. Even if a definitive answer to what this is never found here, this is really a fascinating new area for the team to explore out there in the swamp. I know a lot of people like to bellyache after each and every episode about, oh my God, they didn't find the treasure again. Folks, to me, stuff like this is the treasure. What is this? What a fascinating question. That's going to do it for this episode of Digging Oak Island. Please, as I mentioned before, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Anywhere you get your podcast helps to get the word out on the show. I don't know how, but it does. Also, I want to take a second, and I'll hopefully do this all the time, and thank every one of you who has left a rating so far. I really do appreciate the kind words, and I thank you for taking the time not only to listen, but to do that. I really, really do appreciate. Don't forget, you can also follow the show on Facebook and Twitter. We are at Digging Oak Island. Follow us there. It'd be greatly appreciated. It's a great place to leave your comments and questions and for to discuss the show with fellow listeners. And again, if you do have any questions or comments and you want to send directly to me, you could do so via email at diggingoakisland.com. I'll admit I'm an old-fashioned email kind of guy, and I do like to read things that way. Also, if you do send me an email and you don't want it discussed on the air, please make a note of that. Otherwise, I'm going to consider it fair game for the podcast. So until we speak again, I'm Dave McBride. Thank you for listening to Digging Oak Island.